From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is on his first trip abroad since journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in early October. The Crown Prince is visiting the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia's ally in the war in Yemen. Yesterday, President Trump said the CIA did not conclude that the Crown Prince ordered the murder of Khashoggi, despite reports to the contrary.
Whether he did or whether he didn't, he denies it vehemently. His father denies it, the king, vehemently. The CIA doesn't say they did it. They do point out certain things. And in pointing out those things, you can conclude that maybe he did or maybe he didn't.
Joining us now is BBC Chief International Correspondent Lise Doucette. She's in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Lise, is there any reaction there to what President Trump said yesterday?
Well, I interviewed the Saudi foreign minister this week, Adel Al-Jubeir, who's one of the few, if not the only, senior official in the kingdom responding to these really very severe and consequential allegations being made against the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He described Trump's statement as factual. Now, I think people would, whatever you think of President Trump and the situation in Saudi Arabia or the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, it would be hard to describe President Trump's statement earlier this week, extraordinary statement, as factual. But it's basically they're saying that the Saudi Arabia and the United States are strategic partners, and that as far as the kingdom is concerned, and Adel Al-Jubeir emphasized this time and again, was that they believe that Mohammed bin Salman was not involved at all in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Their official view now and the view of the chief prosecutor is that it was a rogue operation carried out by intelligence agents, and they've arrested, they have 21 people in custody, 11 are indicted and will go on trial. And the prosecutor said he will seek the death penalty for five of them.
How important were President Trump's words, though? If President Trump had come out and said, we believe that MBS actually did have something to do with the killing of Khashoggi, could he have stayed in power in Saudi Arabia if the U.S. president comes out and says he did it?
Well, that's a huge question. But Adel Al-Jubeir used the phrase red line with me this week. He said any disparaging comments made against the Saudi king, King Salman, or against the Crown Prince are a red line for all Saudis. He said any calls to remove or replace the Crown Prince were unacceptable and ridiculous. Another red line for Saudis. He said it is simply not on the agenda. What has President Trump said so far? Well, he's left open a doubt, hasn't he? He said he may well have known about the murder. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Perhaps we will never know. But I think what has been really clear here in the kingdom is that they have believed from day one, and I was here at the start of President Trump's time in office in Saudi Arabia, and every senior Saudi official I spoke to said they believe that President Trump was going to be a good friend and a loyal ally of the kingdom. And so for them, this is just proof of what they have always believed, that President Trump, in the way that he looks at the world through arms deals, through trade, through, as he puts it, American interests, that he will stand shoulder to shoulder with the kingdom, no matter what. And that is why when he made his first foreign trip as president, where did he come? He came to Saudi Arabia.
Now, President Trump is President Trump, but there are calls in the U.S. for sanctions against Saudi Arabia from Congress. The France has also announced it's imposing sanctions against 18 Saudi nationals. The U.K. and Germany also. Is Mohammed bin Salman out of the woods? Is he safe at this point? Or do you think that we're going to continue to see more pressure from not just the U.S., from other countries around the world against the Saudi leadership?
Yes, all that you mentioned is absolutely true. There's even been calls from Senator Lindsey Graham for sanctions against what he described as appropriate members of the royal family. Again, Adel Al-Jubeir, the foreign minister here, said that that would be very short-sighted. When you ask the question, is he out of the woods? Well, if you're in Saudi Arabia, the whole issue, you know, bizarrely looks completely different. You had the King Salman making his annual address to the consultative shura, his son, Mohammed bin Salman, in the front row. He praised his son for the social and economic reform he has carried out. His only instruction to his son was to pay more attention to Saudi youth. This week, the king and Mohammed bin Salman have made a tour of the country, handing out prizes and gifts. Now it's stage two. Mohammed bin Salman has left for a tour of the region. He's in the United Arab Emirates today, seeing one of his closest allies. Next week, he will be at the G20 in Argentina. So from a national tour to a regional tour to an international one, Mohammed bin Salman back on the stage as if, well, as if nothing had happened. But of course, something tragic has happened, and it is a crime, and it's not going to go away.
That's the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, speaking with us from Riyadh. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you're fortunate enough to have a full stomach on this day after Thanksgiving, you might want to thank the American farmer who produced 45 million turkeys for holiday dinner tables and all the fixings. The average American farmer, by the way, is nearly 60 years old. And according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that number keeps creeping up. As older farmers stay in the fields, young farmers are having a tough time finding land to start their own careers. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck reports.
These days, beginning farmers generally fall into one of two categories: those who want to start small, local, and organic operations, or those who want to stay in the family business and grow conventional crops like corn and soybeans. Like John Heaton. He's 26 and sells corn and soybean seed outside Toulon, Illinois. He invited me into his warehouse slash office.
Oh, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. How about you?
But what he really wants to do is farm his own land.
You know, growing up on a family farm, it's what I grew up with, it's what I love.
Heaton's father and grandfather looked for land from retiring farmers, and he's doing the same. But farmers are hanging on longer, and farms continue to be consolidated. Farms of at least 2,000 acres now make up more than a third of all cropland. That's more than double what it was 30 years ago. So a different angle Heaton has tried is a database in Iowa called AgLink that connects tenured farmers with beginning ones, potentially to buy or rent land. David Baker runs AgLink, and he encourages beginning farmers to think of renting first.
Land is by far the last thing I want to see them try and take on and saddle themselves with debt for land, because that's the slowest return on their investment.
Baker's database has about 660 young farmers like Heaton, but only 40 to 45 tenured farmers with land to rent or sell.
I need more of the farm families to say, we have a legitimate business and we'd like to see it go on into the future. We'd like to support our communities by having this business here.
Baker's database is part of the Beginning Farmer Program at Iowa State Extension and Outreach and is a little like a dating service. It starts online, but the real connection has to happen in person.
And through several, you know, conversations, because I think communication is the key to this, is that they either decide, no, this probably isn't what I'm really interested in, or they say, I'm still very interested in what you have. I'd like to come and visit you.
There are farmer networks to do this through, too. Large organized groups or a few guys who regularly meet for coffee. But the next step in starting a farm is nailing down the business side of things. Sherry Doyle is with the Angelic Organics Learning Center in Northern Illinois.
When people come to our program, they tend to be pretty starry-eyed and a little romantic about the notion of farming. And so we do our best to take those rose-colored glasses off.
Doyle's organization runs a course that brings tenured farmers together with new farmers to go over business details, including land acquisition. She says it throws an extra wrench into a farmer's budget.
So when you add on a mortgage to the numbers that you're running, it's quite difficult to make a profit.
That's part of why Doyle also stands behind renting first. But for those who are dead set on buying a small local operation, it's also hard to find 10 to 15-acre pieces of farmable land for sale. Large 100-acre properties are hard to break up, and smaller parcels are attractive to a lot of non-farmers, like retirees and horse owners. Ben Snare and his family faced that challenge and searched for the perfect place for more than a year. They found it outside Beloit, Wisconsin, but even then, there was an issue.
Zoning. It was a big thing that I never really thought of. But it ended up being a really big thing where we weren't even going to be able to put up a greenhouse.
Snare successfully got that changed, but it's hard to maintain a steady profit with a small farm. So they're pivoting toward more meat production and live events, which gives them a more reliable income, and a farm job when they get too old for heavy manual labor. As Snare chases down a cow in the yard, his 4-year-old daughter Emma fills the space.
I just learned a couple letters. O.
Oh.
I learned it today. And then Z, but no B. But there was that one. And then
Emma is already helping the Snares transplant onions, and Ben loves watching his baby Hayden around the chickens. There's even a third possible farmer on the way. But if all three want to farm, a 10-acre by 10-acre plot probably won't cut it. They, too, will likely have to strike it out on their own. For Here and Now, I'm Madeline Beck.
Yesterday, just about everyone in America had a dinner party. And no one knows more about how to throw a dinner party than the hosts of the public radio show The Dinner Party Download, which ended its 10-year run last year. After that, the hosts of the show, Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan, turned their attention to another meal, brunch, and wrote a book called Brunch is Hell, How to Save the World by Throwing a Dinner Party. I spoke with them when the book came out, with Brendan in New York and Rico in L.A., and started by saying I don't agree with the premise. I like brunch, especially with a good Bloody Mary.
Oh, I mean, yeah, maybe at the moment you're served that Bloody Mary, it feels joyous, but the hour it took you to get at that table to drink the Bloody Mary, and then the 2 hours after you have your $75 plate of eggs and avocado toast, that's really the heart of one of 2 days you're given off each week, and you're destroying it by spending it at brunch. So that's the problem. Right. Not the Bloody Mary itself. I support a tomato juice and vodka drink.
Yes, and it's, you know, like after that, maybe that day you were going to, I don't know, write a screenplay, or you were going to go hiking with the kids, or you were going to go visit grandma.
And now you'll now do nothing.
Now that you're day drunk, you're just going to sit on the couch, you're going to turn on, you're going to binge watch something, you're going to hold your belly and moan, and the kids are playing with broken glass, and you don't care, and it's a terrible thing that you've done to yourself and to your world.
Well, and this also gets to the fact that your book is really not about brunch, let's be fair, it's about a dinner party, which many people would say is very similar to brunch. Why do you think it's so different, a dinner party and brunch, just because you don't have a wait?
Yeah, there's that. I mean, the most important thing is that it's more intimate. You're inviting someone into your home, which makes it more anxiety-producing. But it's also what makes it special, because it's one of the few places in modern life where it's not about the commercial transaction. You're not at work. You're not at a PTA meeting. It's a completely free space. Things don't need to be perfect, but people can actually relax in a way that we don't really get an opportunity to. And also, it's at the end of the day, when it's okay if you kind of yawn after you eat food. If you're a little tipsy, big deal. You can go to sleep and wake up tomorrow.
How did you two become such experts on dinner parties, by the way? I mean, you have hosted this show called The Dinner Party Download, and then you've now written this book.
We said so.
Yeah, we said so. We decided to write the – we've written the book on it, so we didn't know we had to answer that question. But seriously, though, I've been cooking for years. My mother is a first-generation immigrant, and our table was always filled with people, everyone coming through over the years. But in reality, it really took place after college, when you get older, and if you do like to cook. I just enjoyed bringing people over and creating this space. And then sure enough, we read articles in the New York Times talking about people are no longer inviting people to their homes, et cetera. And it didn't dawn on me that a lot of people have social anxiety, especially in this world of foodieism, mm-hmm. where people are afraid to cook for each other. You know, they're worried about other people's Instagrams. And it intimidates them.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like, part of it is, in fact, the fact that we named our show The Dinner Party Download. Our show, if you listen to it, isn't like dinner party centric in the sense of that we talk about dinner parties. It's organized like a dinner party. It's really kind of an arts and culture magazine show. But calling it The Dinner Party Download and having that vibe around it made people who were interested in dinner parties gravitate to it, and they would start asking us some of these questions. How do we have conversations like we hear on your show at a party? How do we break the ice with people that maybe are strangers and that we haven't met before?
Well, and you've got a lot of tips in this book for people who want to have a successful dinner party. I want to go through a few of them. First of all, you say that a dinner party should not happen on a Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday. Why is
yes.
that?
Yes. Well, Sunday, I mean, it comes before Monday, so it's already ruined. At the second half of Sunday, you're already worried about work the next day, so you're not going to have people's full attention. They're not going to be able to relax.
Well, a lot of people do have dinner parties, though, on Sunday, and they do probably associate those parties with, like, Game of Thrones or some show that's coming out, right?
It could be linked to a show. But that's not a dinner party.
Right.
If you're inviting people over to watch a TV show, that's not a dinner party. Right. That's okay. A Game of Thrones watching party. That's different.
And then on Monday, you're doing the things you should have been doing on Sunday, so that's not an okay night. And then Tuesdays are just dumb. Like, let's be honest. What's Tuesday night? Now, Wednesday, we're getting on hump day. People are starting to need some relief. They've dug through their emails. They kind of know how the course of their week is going to fall. And that's when we say you can initiate parties. And then we think Thursday is really the filet mignon of the week for dinner parties. It's a great night. People are ready to let loose, and they just have to limp through Friday at work.
And if you do have your dinner party on a Wednesday or a Thursday or a Friday or a Saturday, you say, make sure that you clean your bathroom.
That's right. A lot of people worry. This is one of the biggest worries that people have expressed to us is like, I got to clean my whole house and everything. If you can only clean one room and that's all the time you have, just do the bathroom and you've done at least most of your due diligence. Just get the stubble off of the sink, get the wet, Sunday circular off of the floor and just make it nice and clean, because it is one of the few places, probably the only place in your house that people are going to be at some point alone with a bright light illuminating every corner. You want to make sure that that is not a horror show. If you have time, move on by all means, but that's all you have to do.
Well, actually, that gets to another point, which is you say that you don't really have to cook that much food for a dinner party as long as you cook a little bit.
Well, we say 51% of the food needs to be cooked in your home, because the dinner party is a reflection of you. It's what makes it special. People are coming to your home. They're going to see your books. They're going to be in your house, and the food should represent you. But we allow for 49%. People can bring. You can ask others to bring dessert or bring side dishes. And you don't have to do a 7-course meal, actually. That 51% can really be. We promote something called stunt meat, which is just basically a big ham or a piece of pork or something that actually
roast chicken.
Cooks know this is very simple. You just put it in the oven, start drinking wine, have your phone beep, and then you take it out and you're pretty much good to go.
What do you think about the conversation that's happening at the dinner table, whether it should be one conversation or whether you should be having multiple conversations?
Well, this is interesting. We have a couple of rules. By the way, we're citing a lot of rules. At the beginning of the book, we have what is and is not a dinner party. And in our opinion, a dinner party is between 4 and 12 people. And one of the reasons is because of what you've brought up. After you have 12 people, it's very hard to fit them all around one table and share one conversation, which is really the only point of the dinner in the dinner party, is to make everybody force them to come together in one place and share a conversation over something that they're jointly sharing as well, the food. So I think that inevitably that starts happening, particularly as people get a little bit wilder and tipsier. They might like break off into smaller conversations. But for at least a portion of that dinner part of the evening, I think you should be sharing conversations.
But you should not be sharing the stereo, I guess we should say. If you want to play music, don't allow everybody to have their own pick of what goes on.
No way. This is a musical dictatorship, and it is yours. Or if you have one friend who you trust and respect, you can hand over the iPhone, the records, or whatever music you're using, and we cover them all in the book. They all have their pros and cons to one person, because otherwise it's going to be a complete free-for-all. You're going to be listening to Sly and the Family Stone at 1 minute, just vibing on that, and then next thing you know, Kraftwerk's going to be playing. It's going to be very disjointed, and then you're actually going to have this feeding frenzy around the stereo with people playing songs that really undermines conversation and the kind of warm vibe and glow you want to get at the center of your dinner party.
Now, we haven't talked about one of the big elephants in the room, which is the cell phone. So are you allowed to check your phone at a dinner party?
Oh, the cell phone. The cell phone is the bane of the modern dinner party's existence. We actually have a timeline of things that the dinner party has managed to overcome, challenges to the dinner party's dominance. And frankly, we're worried that it hasn't been able to overcome the advent of the cell phone, which allows you to stream kitten videos at the table.
But our proposal for the cell phone is, look, this is reality. People do have responsibilities. They do want to check in. We do have leadership that's doing erratic things at all times of night and day. So we suggest you kill the cell phone for the most part, but there will become natural lulls in conversation, or maybe transitioning from, the drinks to the dinner, where, allow people almost all at the same time, like, hey, I'm going to check my phone. We all do it at once, and then we proceed from there. I think giving those people those beats, and also their natural beats in a dinner party. When people are going to the bathroom that you cleaned, that's a natural time for them to check their phone. They're also going to check your medicine cabinet, by the way. So you should make sure that that's in good order, because when you invite people in your home, it's a free-for-all. So you can't ban the phone, but really not at the dinner table, not to resolve questions at the dinner table. And there's another element to this, Jeremy. In our book, you know, the heart of it, too, is about how to have conversations, because that's what we do professionally. That's what you do professionally. That doesn't come natural to a lot of folks. And we talk about how to talk to people you disagree with. And we encourage people to invite maybe someone to their dinner party that isn't just a version of themselves. We're a little cheeky in this book, but we do believe in the mission of the dinner party, which is it can enrich our lives.
Now, Rico, you're in Los Angeles. Brendan, you're in New York. I, as you know, because I've worked with both of you, have lived in both of those cities. And I remember one of the first dinner parties that I went to after leaving L.A. And going to New York. It was right around the time that the Higgs boson was discovered. And the host of the dinner party had to go and deal with the food and said, guys, the Higgs boson was just discovered. Discuss. And we did for like 10 minutes. And I thought to myself, this would never happen in Los Angeles. We would never be having this discussion in L.A.
There's plenty of
professors.
Someone
would be like, the
stuff.
Higgs boson was discovered. Someone go get the rights to that. Right, I'm going to go order our gluten-free pizza.
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory is located in Southern California.
Fair enough.
All right.
Well, when you guys are both in the same city, let me know where it is, and I will come for a dinner party. And I will not be a musical dictator, and I will not have the last piece of meat. So there you go.
Could be. I would happily hand off the DJing duties to you, Jeremy. All right. You have excellent taste.
I'll try. That's Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano. They're the authors of Brunch is Hell. Guys, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Oil prices plunged today, falling 7%. They're down about 30% since hitting a high in September. Prices are dropping amid signs that the world economy and oil demand are slowing. Let's bring in Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So they just keep dropping. What's going on?
Well, so the most recent leg down in oil came after Saudi Arabia said it was producing oil at basically a record rate. And its oil minister said that production climbed even further this month into record territory. But there's something else at play. And as you mentioned, the demand side, this drop in oil coincides with a pretty alarming decline in the stock market.
Right.
And that makes a lot of traders and analysts worry that the economy might be softening a bit, especially given all the uncertainty over trade tensions. And there was a report out of Germany today, a purchasing managers index that showed German economic growth is actually fell to the weakest in 4 years. So it all adds up to what they call de-risking in markets, which is when investors sort of get scared about the outlook for the economy and they sort of sell off some of the more risky investments like stocks and oil that would not benefit if the economy does slow down.
Well, when you talk about a bad time for the stock market, we're looking now. The Dow is closed today. The market closed at 1 o'clock Eastern time today, and the Dow fell another 178 points. It's down to 24,285. It was up near 27,000 in the last couple of months. It is the worst Thanksgiving week for the Dow since 2011. Apple is down 25% since hitting an all-time high earlier this year. This is starting to look a little more significant every day that things drop.
It is. Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, part of it is that last year we were spoiled with this market that was just kept going up and up without a lot of volatility. So to some degree, this is sort of a reversion to more normal atmosphere for markets with, you know, some nasty drawdowns like this. But you're absolutely right. It's gotten to the point where it's making people you know, a lot of people think the stock market sort of foreshadows the path of the economy. So people are worried that, you know, we had this sort of boost to growth from tax cuts, but that it's coming back to earth now. And, you know, we could be in for a little bit of a slowdown. slowdown?
Well, when President Trump looks at what's happening in the oil markets, he's been calling the price drop in oil a tax cut for America. He said, thank you, Saudi Arabia, but let's go lower. You know, gas prices are starting to follow oil prices down. Is there any benefit to seeing what's happening with oil prices dropping?
Well, it's a very complicated question to answer because the U.S. has become such a large producer of oil because of the fracking boom and other innovations in drilling that it's not such an easy thing to say that a drop in oil prices is unambiguously good for the U.S. economy. I mean, there are a lot of jobs created in the U.S. because of this energy boom that we've seen. So certainly for many consumers, the drop in gas prices, you know, it's not exactly a one-to-one relationship. Gas, the AAA gasoline average price has come down about 11.5% while oil's fallen. It likely will come down further if oil remains this low. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, something important to realize is natural gas prices have shot up almost 50% since the end of September, mainly because it's been so cold in the Northeast.
Right.
So if you look at both ends of your energy bill, in some cases, it's almost a wash.
Mike Regan at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Now that the Thanksgiving feast is over and done, you might want to check out a film this holiday weekend. And so we have got with us today John Horn, host of KPCC's The Frame, with some suggestions. John, welcome back. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
So this is the time of the year when the movie studios start to roll out the films that they think are going to win Oscars because they want them to be fresh on the minds of the Academy voters in time for the Oscars coming up in just a few months.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, over the last couple of months, it's been kind of the dregs of late summer, early fall. And now that The Grinch and Venom and Halloween are behind us, the studios are starting to roll out their prestige films. And you're right. The thinking is that if the films come out late in the year, they're going to be top of mind for Academy voters when they start putting their nominations in toward the end of the year. So that's why it's such a dramatic change from what has come before and what's coming out now.
Okay, so let's get to some of the ones that you are putting on the radar for us, starting with Green Book, which just opened. It is based on a true story and stars Mahershala Ali as Don Shirley, a Jamaican-American pianist who embarks on a tour of the South in 1962, and he needs a driver and some protection, so he hires Tony Lip, a bouncer from the Bronx, played by Viggo Mortensen. And here's a scene with the two men in a restaurant.
How is that?
Salty.
Have you ever considered becoming a food critic?
No. Not really. Why, is there money in it?
I'm just saying you have a marvelous way with words when describing food. Salty. So vivid one can almost taste it.
Okay, so it seems like there's a culture clash between the two of them. What's your take on this film?
I think it's a really good movie. I mean, there's a couple interesting things about this film. One, it's directed by Peter Farrelly. And when you think of him as a filmmaker, you think of kind of lowbrow comedies like Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary. I think it's a really interesting film. It's set in the early 1960s. It's a road trip about these two guys who really don't have anything in common, trying to learn something from one another. It's also a portrait of America before the Civil Rights Act, when it felt like we were moving in a good direction in terms of desegregation. And yet, Green Book is a reference to the hotel guide where African Americans would look for lodging because they couldn't stay where people of white skin could stay. So I think it's a beautiful movie. It really celebrates Don Shirley's music, great buddy story, and it actually has a lot of political significance today.
Okay, so that's one. Another you have brought to our attention is one for maybe people who like to watch political movies. This is The Front Runner. It's about Gary Hart's 1988 presidential campaign, which got derailed by allegations that he was having an extramarital affair. Here is a scene with Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart and J.K. Simmons. Bill Dixon, his campaign manager, can't believe that Hart won't address the allegations, even with his own campaign workers.
People are sacrificing for you.
And I'm not sacrificing what? Should I sacrifice my privacy, Bill, my self-respect? And it won't just be me that gets dragged down. None of those kids you're talking about will work another campaign where some candidate doesn't have to account for who comes and goes from their bedroom. And that is just the beginning.
Okay. But we're not talking about that right now.
I am talking about that.
We're talking about how you get through today without pissing away everything we've all worked for on this campaign.
Bill, this campaign is about the future, not rumors, not sleaze. And I care about the sanctity of this process, whether you do or do not.
See, now I will see that movie. That sounds really interesting to me. Probably for a lot of our listeners who are political junkies as well.
Well, I always think it's a bad idea over Thanksgiving, especially if you're with relatives and specifically if you're with in-laws, to do anything that has anything to do with politics.
Fair enough.
That said, and this is a movie that came out a couple weeks ago, and sadly, I think it's really not getting a lot of attention. It is a film obviously about Gary Hart and about what happened to him. The amazing thing about the Gary Hart story is that in a week, he went from the front runner, not only for the Democratic nomination, but likely the next president of the United States, to out of politics for good. And what it has to say about the media and how far we have come, if we've come at all, how low we sank then, and what's happened to the media and its coverage of presidential candidates since then, I think is fascinating. I think it's an important film, and I think its relevance, a lot like Green Book today, can't be overstated.
Okay, another film on your list is The Favorite, not Your Favorite. That's the name of the movie, The Favorite. It is set in early 18th century England and stars Olivia Colman as Britain's monarch, Queen Anne. Rachel Weisz is Lady Sarah, Queen Anne's close friend, who's pretty much ruling both the queen and the country because of Anne's poor health. Emma Stone plays Abigail, a new servant who might threaten Lady Sarah's position. Let's listen to a scene here where a cup of hot chocolate becomes a point of contention among the three women.
None to the Queen.
What?
Well, you cannot have hot chocolate. Your stomach, the sugar inflames it.
Abigail, hand me that cup.
Do not.
I'm sorry. I do not know what to do.
Oh, fine. Give it to her. And then you can get a bucket and a mop for the aftermath.
So I guess there's a rule every year that there has to be at least one film about the British monarchy. And here it is. But what do you think?
I will warn you, this is not The Crown. Yorgos Lanthimos has made a couple of films. His first film was The Lobster. Then he made a film, The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Now, this is a potentially polarizing film. This is probably the most accessible of his films. But that's kind of like saying a jalapeno is not as hot as a ghost pepper. It is an acquired taste. And there's some great performances. And even though it's set in early 18th century, there's a modern language and spirit to the making of this film. It does have some eccentricities. I think it's a beautiful film. And to see a major release that has not one, not two, but three women in starring roles is extraordinary. It may be even more polarizing than The Front Runner. People are going to argue about it, but I think it's a beautiful film that certainly is worth checking out.
And Olivia Colman, by the way, is taking over the role of Queen Elizabeth in The Crown on Netflix.
Yeah, she is going from Queen Anne to what, Queen Elizabeth? Is that what we're up to
right.
in The Crown? And it's certainly a very different performance.
Okay, another one that you wanted to highlight for us is a film starring Willem Dafoe. It is called At Eternity's Gate. Now, Willem Dafoe was nominated for an Oscar last year in The Florida Project. In this film, he plays Vincent van Gogh. Here he is talking about what happens when he paints.
When I paint, I stop thinking.
About what?
I stop thinking, and I feel that I'm a part of everything outside and inside of me.
What do you think of this film, yet another film about Vincent van Gogh that's been made just in the last few years?
Yeah, I think when we think of Vincent van Gogh, we assume the film is going to be about his mental illness, the fact that he was not recognized in his lifetime as a painter. This is a different look at van Gogh. It is really about how van Gogh saw light, how he saw color, and how he painted. Willem Dafoe was taught by the film's director, Julian Schnabel, who's an artist, how to paint. And yes, it does get into some of the tragedies of van Gogh's life, but it is really a beautiful film that was shot largely where van Gogh painted. It really is a gorgeous film, unbelievably photographed. And I think if you like van Gogh or have an appreciation of his painting, this is a insight into how he painted. And I think it's a gorgeous film. And I think Willem Dafoe is going to be nominated again for an Academy Award for playing van Gogh.
What movies are on your horizon that'll be coming out in the next month that are also maybe going to get some Oscar buzz that people should keep an eye out for?
I think, a movie that a lot of people are going to be talking about through the end of the year, and it's in a handful of theaters right now where Oscar voters are. It's coming out on Netflix in early December, is Roma. It's Alfonso Cuarón's film about his childhood in Mexico. Beautiful film. Barry Jenkins, who made Moonlight, has a new film based on the writings of James Baldwin called If Beale Street Could Talk. And then there's a fascinating documentary about Roger Ailes, the growth of Fox News, called Divide and Conquer. Very different films, very interesting stories, all of them highly recommended, coming out later this year. Roma, Divide and Conquer, and If Beale Street Could Talk.
I'm still catching up on last year's Oscar nominees. I was just on a flight. Seriously, I was just on a flight back from London, and I was able to watch two films that I wasn't able to see last year, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and The Shape of Water, which won. They were both great, but I actually still think, having seen them, that Get Out should have won the Best Picture. But that's just my opinion. I don't know what you think.
It might have been really close. Who knows?
Maybe. Okay, that's John Horn, who hosts the KPCC show The Frame. You can see a list of all of John's film recommendations at hereandnow.org. John, thanks again.
My pleasure.
And we thought we'd leave you with the music of the real Don Shirley, the pianist portrayed by Mahershala Ali in Green Book. This is his version of At Last. About 20% of the U.S. population has dyslexia, and states across the country have been rethinking how their schools address the issue. Kansas has been one of the last states to take action, but now an education task force there is considering strategies to help dyslexic students learn how to read. Celia Yopis-Jepson from the Kansas News Service reports.
Here's what structured literacy sounds like.
If I have the k sound, and I'm using that with an A, O, U, or another consonant, what do I use?
A C.
Excellent.
Structured literacy is an explicit approach to teaching sounds and spelling, like learning the I after E, except after C rule, but a whole lot more of that. Teachers drill students on complicated rules of phonics and spelling that many of us don't know consciously.
If I have a one-syllable base word, vowel is short, final sound, ch. What do I use?
TCH.
Excellent.
Many dyslexia advocates and researchers say the method works, where traditional teaching fails. They won over Bert Moore, a superintendent in rural southeast Kansas, whose student, Harrison, you just heard receiving instruction online with video conferencing software.
Lo and behold, we found out it did help.
Moore hired structured literacy specialists 70 miles away to help a few students with dyslexia. His school had tried other techniques, but nothing worked. Kansas is on the cusp of making this explicit teaching available to more kids at school. Parents have lobbied for it for years, so the state legislature created a task force of lawmakers, parents, educators, and the chairman of the State Board of Education. Some ideas on the table, pushing colleges of education to teach structured literacy, or nudging elementary schools to use it. For all kids, not just those with dyslexia. That prospect thrills some people. Others, not so much.
King without k.
Ing.
Man without m.
An.
Here's what we know. Without learning to read takes more effort for kids with dyslexia. They have a harder time engaging part of the brain that tells us words are made of sounds that you can break apart.
Mad without m.
Add.
Drilling like this at Pittsburgh State University's Dyslexia Center in Kansas with 8-year-old Dylan aims to stimulate sound awareness and open the door to letters, reading, writing. Psychology professor David Herford explains.
Those manipulations are important because if you don't understand that words are made up of sounds, then when you get to the point where you're decoding words, that makes no sense to you.
Many parents and teachers who work with dyslexic children say decades of research shows explicit sound and spelling instruction benefits all kids. Though schools do some of it, they say it's not nearly enough. They see a chance to help the more than 1/4 of Kansas students who lag behind in reading. Angie Schreiber's son, now grown, has dyslexia. She goes with other parents to their meetings with teachers to push for structured literacy. She says teachers at those meetings say the same stuff she's heard for 20 years.
Don't know anything about dyslexia. Don't know how to teach dyslexia. Didn't check this student for phonology. And no wonder this kid can't read.
This is the frustrating part, and I agree with Angie.
State Senator Bruce Givens is a special education administrator.
We recognize that the universities were not preparing our teachers with the skills necessary to teach in the early 1990s. We're hiring people. I'm hiring people that don't have the skills that were listed as necessary in your own research.
But other education groups and reading specialists fear that Kansas will overestimate the prevalence of dyslexia. They say dyslexia advocates are misinterpreting what research says about the effectiveness of structured literacy. And they worry rigid drilling takes the fun out of reading. Annie Opat, a literacy expert at Emporia State University, says studies don't show dyslexic students, let alone others, need a structured literacy approach. She's attended some of the training structured literacy advocates like so much and wasn't impressed.
It's item knowledge, and item knowledge meaning that, you know, they're learning this letter and it's not related to meaning. So that, to me, is not the optimal way for the brain to take on new learning, because usually when you want to take on new learning, it's better to have a foundation of something that's meaningful.
Kansas teachers' colleges are mostly unrepresented on the state task force, prompting concern from deans. David Herford is the only professor. Skeptics like Annie Opat aren't at the table. For Here and Now, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
And here's a bit of good news from Europe. Officials monitoring the Leaning Tower of Pisa in Italy say the world-famous landmark is straightening out. The bell tower was built in 1173 and it started leaning almost immediately because the sand and clay is softer on one side of the 190-foot building. In 1990, the tower was closed to visitors for the first time in 800 years so it could be shored up. That work reduced the tilt by nearly 16 inches, and now officials say the tower is still righting itself. The latest measurements show the Leaning Tower of Pisa has straightened up another inch and a half. But don't worry, it still looks crooked, so if you go to Pisa, you can still get that picture of yourself trying to hold the tower up. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.